So today I'm going to talk about some work I've been doing in collaboration mainly with Rashid Sunyaev and Rishi Khatri at MPA, and then also Adrian Eriksek and Ido Bendajan, who you guys all know. So I'm going to try to excite you why, you know, measuring the CMB spectrum, really the deviations from the black body, could be a really interesting thing to look at in the future. But I wanted to start just by saying, we all know this picture, you know, the CMB anisotropies. A lot of people, you know, lots of work has gone into that, and there's great detail we have learned about our universe. This is all just a bit of propaganda. I'm also not very, democratic here. I'm going to show some slides of ACT. But the bottom line is we understand our universe, you know, at a very high level of precision. There's lots of things which are coming up, SC measurements, and, you know, there's really great detail about our universe we understand. And you can start asking questions. Here I highlighted, for example, helium abundance. You know, the damping tail of the CMB is now becoming so precise and measured that you can actually just measure the basically helium contents with some significance. And that will, of course, improve. And, you know, there's, of course, the important questions about inflationary physics and what is, you know, the kind of models of inflation. So as I said, that was just all propaganda and about the, you know, CMB anisotropies. But if we look at the CMB spectrum, so the energy distribution, we know from Kobe Firas that, you know, the spectrum is very close to a black body, you know, really, really close. Very, very little room left for, you know, deviations from a black body. Here parameterized as mu and y parameter. I will explain that in more detail in what follows. But this is like, you know, this 20 years, 25 years ago. And, you know, since then, technology has advanced, and there has been little progress made in this direction. But there's hope that there will be some progress with PIXI, which I will mention in some of the next slides. So why would one actually expect any deviations from a black body? So if you just look at the early universe, everything is in full thermodynamic equilibrium at very high redshifts. You know, everything is ionized. We have photons and electrons and the medium just in equilibrium, and you should not expect any distortions from that. Everything is very simple as well. You can, you know, write down everything just by writing down the temperature of the photon field. Number densities are very, very, you know, it's all very simple physics. And when you now are looking at, you know, processes which could perturb equilibrium, something which is happening, then you would expect that there's a distortion. Just a simple example. If you inject some energy, if you just change all the photons, if you just give them a shift in energy and change their energy density, you didn't adjust the photon number, which means you're going to produce, you know, you're not going to be able to describe the spectrum which you result. Even if you, find a new equilibrium, you will not be able to describe the spectrum by just one number, by the temperature. So you need to know as well the number density, which is giving you a chemical potential. The question is, of course, which kind of processes could be leading to any energy release? And here's a list, which I will not have time to go through. And there's even processes, of course, this is not an exhaustive list. There's other processes which could be there. For example, dissipation of magnetic fields has been discussed as well. And there's other possibilities. But this is a list which gives you a feeling that there is actually many processes possible, and people have been discussing these processes. I will only focus on a few. I will highlight those which are actually something which you expect in the standard cosmological paradigm. So there's the adiabatically cooling electrons or matter, just from the adiabatic expansion of the universe, which I will explain leads to an energy extraction and therefore creates a negative chemical potential. Then there's, you know, even thermally produced dark matter should be annihilating at some rate, so there's energy release from that in some sense. Of course, you can put constraints as well from CMB anisotropies. And then there's these acoustic modes in the early universe which are dissipating and releasing their energy, and you can learn about inflation from this because you are, you know, interested in what the small-scale power spectrum is. And then there's also the cosmological recombination epoch, which I will mention briefly at the end, which leads to energy release just by creating, you know, the recombination photons. Why is this all exciting? I mentioned already earlier that there's this PIXI proposal, which is, you know, an idea to measure bipolarization with a high sensitivity and also measure the CMB monopole, the average spectrum, with extremely high precision. And the interesting thing is the really interesting numbers are, you know, you will get mu and y distortion, basically a factor of 1,000 improvement on the limits from Kobe-Firas. And that allows you to really ask, you know, interesting questions about processes which, you know, would otherwise not be detectable. So how does the thermalization problem, how does thermalization work? Because if you want to calculate what the kind of distortions is you get, so Pixie got didn't get selected in the last round when they were proposed. It's a mid-class, you know, it's 200 million emission. But they got apparently, at least when I was talking to Al Kogut, they got a very positive feedback for their proposal. So they are certainly going to try to propose again. And there's also, in addition, from the European side, there's this core. Mission, which you know, got they proposed it, but they didn't. It again didn't get selected. They so far have only like a B polarization. They want to do basically 10 times better than Planck HFI, but they are now thinking about, you know, adding as well a spectral measurement on top of it. So there is at least motion in the direction of, you know, trying to measure spectral distortions in the future. There is Arcade, which is a balloon, but. From the ground, really getting the monopole, it will be very hard. I mean, I've been discussing with people, and you know, if you probably if you just think about putting a huge bolometer array and just looking at a very small patch of the sky and integrating for a long time, you could think about measuring the average spectrum there. But you know, all these things are it's very hard. So, especially when you're talking about, you know, improving a factor of 1,000 the sensitive the level. From Kobe-Firas, you will probably want to go to space. So, yeah, how does the thermalization problem work? Here are just a couple of important conditions. So, in the early universe before recombination, you have INS plasma and all this stuff. Then you have Coulomb interactions, which are basically establishing full equilibrium between the protons and electrons, and then that couples makes everything just be a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution, and the medium is very, very simple. You don't have to really worry about, you know, inhomogeneities in the medium in the matter distribution. So you really are just thinking about looking at the average at an average evolution of the spectrum, which makes the problem very simple. And then of course you have to think about this in an expanding universe on an expanding background. Okay, those are just some simple statements. But what I told you already that if you have energy release, you are changing the energy density, but you have to do something with the distortion which is created. So the first thing you have to think about is how do you redistribute photons? If you, for example, have an annihilation line and you're just injecting some photons at some frequency, you want to communicate them over all frequencies, and that's a process which is that is achieved by Compton scattering. So you just have the interaction with the free electrons. The photons get redistributed, and these are, you know, some of these early pictures on discussion of, you know, Companies equation and how this affects the CMB spectrum. Here, the thermal set effect is something which probably all of you know, and it's just like a very inefficient upscattering of photons. So the other thing is when you're just redistributing photons over frequency, you haven't adjusted the number of photons, because you need to add in order to get a zero chemical potential. You need to add photons if you have a higher energy density of the photon field corresponding to the particular equilibrium temperature. So for that, you need some production process which is emitting photons. The first thing you come up with is just Bremsstrahlung, but that is very inefficient at high redshifts. Because it's basically photons times number density of protons or electrons. It's the square of the baryon density, and that is in comparison to the photon field, of course, suppressed by a large factor because of the large specific entropy. So the other process which is important is double Compton scattering, and this is a process interaction of this form. So you have an electron and a photon. And instead of conserving the number of photons, you actually emit a low-frequency photon. So it's just a first order radiative correction basically to the Compton scattering process. And that process is pretty efficient at high redshifts and is the main source of soft photons to thermalize things. So soft photons, I'm already emphasizing here, they are mainly produced at low frequencies. So the picture is the following. You have the photons emitted at low frequencies, and then Compton scattering just moves those photons up to high frequencies and thermalizes high frequency distortions. So this is kind of shown here in this sketch, where you have, you start, here it's even started from zero spectrum, and you just have energy density in the electrons. And then these electrons start emitting photons because they are unhappy, because there's no photons around, but that's not in equilibrium for them. So they start emitting photons at low frequencies and then move them slowly up to high frequencies. And as you go higher and longer in time, here parameterized as the Y parameter, you get more and more close to the equilibrium black body. And this was calculated here for Bremsstrahlung only. For double Compton, this process will be much faster. So this was just an example in those days when Ilarionov and Tsunyaev were calculating these thermalization processes. So the two important distortions, I mentioned this already in some slide earlier, are the Y-type and mu-type distortion. Y-type is just the Sunyaev-Seldovich effect, spectral distortion, which is equivalent of the Sunyaev-Seldovich effect, where you have a decrement at low frequencies and an increment of the spectrum at high frequencies because of basically partial upscattering. And here it's shown basically as a delta T over T, where you have this decrement and increment here. The chemical potential distortion is slightly different, where you are having a very strong interaction with the Compton scattering. So you're able to communicate very fast over the whole frequency distribution, where here you're just partially communicating within the Doppler scattering width. So you're just shifting by a bit. But in the case of the mu distortion of the chemical potential, you're actually communicating over the whole spectrum. So you're getting a kinetic equilibrium with respect to the Compton interaction. But you don't have enough photons which are produced. So you're still ending up with a distortion which is characterized by the chemical potential. And the shape, just to say again, the shape is that you have a constant chemical potential at high frequencies, which is determined by how many photons you have been producing from the time of the injection of energy and how much energy you had injected. These are just some examples to show this explicitly, but the typical distortions are much smaller, of course, if you, Another way to plot this, maybe more familiar, is here again, it's frequency and here's the intensity in some particular units. It's not so crucial. The SZ type distortion has this shape, and you all know this shape. Here's the null. And the mu, the chemical potential distortion, looks slightly different. It has a different crossing frequency, and it has a slightly different shape in terms of the maxima and minima. Okay, I think it is illustrative to just show how if you inject some energy, how the evolution of the spectrum actually looks when you solve that problem numerically. So here I show again basically the spectrum as a function of frequency. It's not that I'm, this is to very low frequencies, but it's just to show how the evolution is actually, affected at low frequencies and high frequencies. The interesting frequencies for current observations are kind of in this regime, where the Sunyaev-Seldovich effect peak, if you look at this previous slide, you see that, this is the kind of range where people are actually measuring something. And this low frequency is just for illustration here.
So one point is that this process is like double Compton and Bremsstrahlung, they are more efficient at low frequency.
Yes.
So you might actually change the number of photons at low frequency.
Exactly, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. You do change everywhere, but they are most efficient at low frequencies. And then Compton interaction, when that is still fast, it allows you to communicate the photons up to the high frequency where they are missing.
So my point is that the mu distortion then wouldn't be exactly
a mu
distortion at low frequencies, because
a
mu distortion is only for fixed number of particles.
Yeah. So I'm going in the wrong direction. The mu distortion at high frequencies becomes, if you don't inject any photons, you're creating a constant chemical potential throughout.
Yes.
If you have a positive chemical potential, which means a deficit of photons, you had injected injected energy. If you have a negative chemical potential, you actually took energy away. And at low frequencies, things return to a black body because there the photon production process is extremely fast.
There you have mu is not constant.
It goes down to zero frequency to zero chemical potential at low frequencies, where you inject the photons. This is just to show example, yeah. So this is just to an example. So I just assume there's some decaying relic particle. I'm not going to talk about relic particles and decays in more detail, but this is just an illustrative example. The total energy which I assumed was injected is 10 to minus 6-ish. And the main, most of the energy release is happening at 2 times 10 to the 6. This is actually an important number because this is basically where below that redshift, energy release above that redshift, double Compton scattering and Compton scattering are so efficient that you actually can inject a lot of energy and you don't end up with any appreciable distortion. While below that redshift, you actually can create a distortion. And what you will see is that above that redshift, the redshift is shown here. I hope you can see. I start at very high redshifts, 10 to the 7. So thermalization should be extremely efficient there. You shouldn't see any distortion, distortion in terms of the temperature. However, energy release does lead to a shift in the temperature of the photon field because it means that the photons are just black body moving upwards. And you will see that there is a distortion a signature created here, which is just meaning that you're moving from one black body to another black body. If I start this calculation, this is just a black body, but now you can see you're coming close to the time of most energy release. You see that there's this distortion at high frequencies created, which is a mu distortion with positive chemical potential. And then at low frequencies, you see this characteristic temperature dip, which now, as time goes by, just moves, becomes more and more thermalized and moves towards higher frequencies. The peak moves towards higher frequencies. At late times, also the electrons decouple from the photons below recombination. And at that time, they are cooling below the temperature of the photon field, so they are unhappy with the low frequency CB. And they're actually absorbing photons here. This is a small effect. It's very low frequency, but it's just to show the physics of the problem. It's really the electrons are dropping below the photon field, and they are eating the photons at low frequencies. They are not able to eat photons at high frequencies because the absorption is not important there. And it's also not, at this time, there's no communication for photons from high frequencies to low frequencies anymore because the Compton scattering is very slow. And you're basically just having an effect at low frequencies. Okay. So here's a couple of processes now which lead to energy release. I already said now the cooling of electrons in the early universe, they are just adiabatically cooling. That means if you would leave them alone, they would their temperature would scale like Z to the second power. But the photons are interacting with them via Compton scattering, and that means they are all the time heated. That means the photons are feeling some extraction of energy because the electrons always want to cool down, but they are kept at the same temperature as the photons by the Compton interaction at early times, very efficient. And you're basically balancing Compton cooling, Compton heating, so energy transfer from the photons to the electrons basically balances the adiabatic cooling due to the expansion. But the electrons always have a temperature which is slightly below the photon temperature. So here's just redshift, again, high redshift, very low redshifts, and here's basically the relative difference between the photon and electron temperature. And I just put the negative sign, this is meaning the electrons are colder than the photons. So this is just, if you don't include any of this thermalization problem, and if you include the thermalization problem of this sort, you get this kind of difference. And the interesting thing is that the redshift scaling of this energy extraction rate is actually having the same redshift scaling as annihilating dark matter would have. It's just density square. It's not, the physics is different, of course, because it's really the adiabatic cooling, but it has the same redshift scaling at high redshifts. At low redshifts, this is not correct, but at high redshifts, it does. So that means that there is a possibility to cancel energy release. If you have dark matter decaying, or annihilating, it would be leading to energy release, but at the same time, you're having this sink of energy by the adiabatic expansion, and you can cancel the distortion. I will mention that in a minute. So if you calculate the evolution again of this problem, just, you know, nothing, no energy, extra energy release, just the electrons and the matter expanding and continuously extracting energy from the photon field, you see this kind of evolution. Again, I started at high redshifts. And then you see here, this is just a thermal, you know, the electrons extract energy, so the photon field becomes a bit colder. And then you see this chemical potential distortion arising at low frequencies, which is now quite the opposite sign from what it was before. It's just a negative chemical potential. And then as time goes by and you're coming closer to the recombination epoch, this is now 10,000, you see again that the electrons are now strongly cooling below the photon field, and they are eating photons at low frequencies. And you see as well that there is this slight upscattering of photons, well, actually downscattering of photons, again, because of the electrons being cooling and basically extracting energy. And you see this kind of shape here, which is characteristic of a mixture. There will be a bit of a Y distortion added here. So, this is just Compton scattering, double Compton Bremsstrahlung, and the expansion of the universe, basically, but as well following the electron temperature, so that you are really getting the difference between the photon and electron temperature included. And you can estimate the effect just using this, you know, classical formula where you say the total energy release or extraction by just basically equating number of photons and energy density of photons using those constraints. You get this kind of estimate for the chemical potential, and you can write down the estimate for the Y distortion as well. And this is actually in pretty good agreement with what you get numerically. You can see here the numbers are pretty small. They are 3 × 10⁻⁹, which is, you know, of the order of it's basically roughly a factor of 5 below the sensitivity of PIXI. But nevertheless, this is a process which should be there, and it allows you to basically weigh the baryons in the universe, because this is nothing else than telling you how many baryons are in the universe and how much energy how much capacity they have, heat capacity. So I mentioned dark matter annihilation, and here's just, I hope this plot is clear by now. So this is frequency, and this is basically now the effective temperature of the photon field relative to the background photon field. So this is the case which I just showed, the negative chemical potential. And if you now have some extra source of energy release, for example, by annihilation, then you can actually diminish this chemical potential and make it nearly zero. And you can also overheat and get a positive chemical potential when you go and crank up the annihilation rate. As I said, the scaling of the annihilation is basically z to the 6th power if you compare to compare this to the expansion adiabatic cooling. And the critical annihilation rate is basically this 2 × 10⁻²³ EV per second. Just for reference, this is actually a number which is also from the CMB anisotropies. You can put a constraint on this, because if you annihilate particles during recombination, you're delaying recombination, and that changes your visibility function of the CMB anisotropies. And that means that you're getting you would see some changes in this in the power spectra. And the power spectra nowadays are with WMAP and combination with ACT and SPT already really tightly constraining this and putting actually an upper limit which is of order of this number on this. So measuring the spectrum, if one would be measuring the spectrum, one would be in principle just competing with the constraint from the anisotropies. So in some sense that is not so interesting, because annihilating dark matter will be constrained 6 times better, basically. This limit will go a factor of 6 down when you now have the Planck data. But the interesting thing is, this case is continuous energy release over all times, also through recombination. If you have energy release which is stopping well before recombination, or you know, just before recombination, you will not see this in the CMB anisotropies, but you will see it in the spectrum. So this is an interesting aspect of the spectral distortions. It actually allows you basically to dig deeper in the history of the universe. Yes? Yeah, but that's true. But it is true that the detailed cancellation, especially of this cooling process from the adiabatic cooling with the dark matter, would be depending on that, because you would be basically. I will show a slide which shows more clearly what are the different. If you have a chemical potential error, you might be. If the decoupling is not in the chemical potential error, then the mixture of chemical potential in the distortion will be different if there is dark matter is decoupling in a different way. But as I understand, for most models, probably you would expect that this decoupling is happening much, much earlier, and then you basically have just a continuous energy release coming from the dark matter. And of course, there's effects like, you know, is it P wave, S wave annihilation, or is it, you know, all these things you can model and include in principle. Okay, so the dissipation of acoustic modes in the early universe. That's again a process which should be there. It is a standard process, and there's no way to discuss this, to get rid of it in some sense. The amplitude might be, you know, differing by a lot, and I will try to explain this. So here is again the CMB anisotropies. I showed you this picture before. And if we look at the power spectrum, here I show some SPT power spectra, we understand that at small scales, there is this, you know, damping tail, which everybody knows about. It's caused by the silt damping, and it has been now measured very precisely. But if you would be kind of excluding this process of silt damping, then the power which is there would be, you know, this is from just an illustration from a paper by Wayne Hu, then there would be, you know, much, much more power in comparison to what we see today. And this energy, which was stored in these, you know, perturbations, this must have gone somewhere, right? So there's two possibilities, of course. One is that you just redistributed energy from small scales to large scales. So you would be expecting an excess of power here. That would be like conserving the power within the perturbations, but it's, you know, it appears that this is actually not true. There has been like power, you know, energy being released, which means there should be a distortion created. And if you just think for a moment about what this means, or how, what kind of dependencies one should be seeing, of course, it all depends on what is the amplitude of the small scale power spectrum. If you have more small-scale power, you will have more energy release, and you will get a larger distortion. Then, of course, the shape is important. If you have, you know, just scale-invariant power spectrum, that will be different from a power spectrum which has, you know, a flaring at low at small scales. And those kind of possibilities can, in principle, be discussed and constrained. Then, of course, the dissipation scale is important. So, what is the contents of bions? And relativistic species in the universe, that is somehow a way to look at neutrinos, relativistic you know, degrees of freedoms, because that changes. And for example, in our universe, and I will mention this again, the mu distortions are created by dissipation of scales which are 50 inverse megaparsecs to 10,000 inverse megaparsecs, very, very small scales. Then there's additional possibilities one can discuss. So there's the primordial non-Gaussianity. Ichiro was here just recently and talked about, you know, this. I will mention this again. And then there's also a dependence on the type of the perturbations you have. If you have adiabatic perturbations, the, you know, transfer functions, if you just want to put it in a very simple term, the transfer functions are very different if you have adiabatic or other curvature modes, or neutrino other curvature modes. So in principle, one is sensitive to what kind of modes of perturbations one has. So how does this work? If you just go to the classical textbooks and you ask, what is the energy density stored in a sound wave? Then, you know, Landau Lifshitz tells you, okay, here's some energy density. It depends on the sound speed square. The density particle mass density, and you have the perturbation square. But this is, you know, the classical classical non-relativistic limit of this equation. And if you now just apply this limit to the photon baryon fluid, then you can replace, you know, sun speed square. It's basically one third of the speed of light square. And you can say, okay, mass density is something like energy density of the photons. And perturbations in the photon field are just related to temperature perturbations. So you plug in those numbers and do the math. Then you can say, okay, the changes in the total energy which is stored in the wave, if I just take the time derivative of that in co-moving coordinates, so that I'm taking out the normal Hubble expansion, then I get this kind of expression, which just depends on the monopole, average monopole, and you know, there's a minus sign, because if you decrease the energy stored in the monopole, that means you have an increase in the energy release. And this is basically the expression you get from this. And this kind of evolution here can be calculated very simply with, you know, standard with CAMP or CMB-FAST, and we all have seen this kind of transfer functions for the monopole here. I just show a particular mode of 10 inverse megaparsecs. And then as a function of the scale factor, so very high redshifts and low redshifts, and you see, as the mode comes closer to the horizon, enters, it starts oscillating, and then it dumps away and decays. So you see this disappeared. The energy stored in that mode has disappeared and leads to energy release. However, it turns out that this is not the giving you actually, and I will try to argue how one has to try change this. This is not giving you the quite the right answer. So the first thing is that the total energy release, which is kind of estimated in this way, is actually by different by a factor of 9/4 if you do this with a full Boltzmann treatment. And then also the interesting thing is only 1/3 of this energy actually really leads to distortions. And the remaining 2/3, of course, the energy is released, but it does only shift the temperature of the CMB. So it just leads to a shift in the black body temperature, but no distortion. So
is that exact number, 1/3 or 2/3, or is it
some kind of? No, this is basically exact. I will explain now. So thinking about the problem in a different way, you know that there at every time in the universe there's somehow, you know, this. If you're sitting as an electron somewhere in the universe, at some time you can look around yourself and you can see a CMB anisotropy. This is, you know, our snapshot at Z of zero. But at high redshifts, of course, in the very early stages, things are just very much more simple. You see a monopole, you see a dipole, and you see a quadrupole probably. But then the higher multiples are kind of like, you know, the power in those multiples at very early times before recombination is not there. It's not much power there. But you can still estimate, if you just think about these photon field, spatially varying photon field in a box, you can just estimate what is the total, how is the total energy density look like. So you just write down the average of black body spectra, basically the energy density of black bodies. It's just nothing else than the average of the t to the 4, and you do the, you know, perturbations expansion, and here this average goes to zero because you're thinking about, you know, these perturbations in first order vanishing. But in second order, you see that there's this term which is 6 times temperature perturbation square averaged. Okay, if you now take the co-moving, this derivative, which is taking out basically the main scaling, then you end up with this equation. And you can see two things. First of all, the coefficient is different. It was 16/3, if I'm not incorrect, before. And then also here, it is actually depending on all multiples. It's not only depending on the monopole, but it depends on all multiples. It turns out that if you now calculate this, you can calculate this from first order with inserting basically first order perturbation theory. You find that the monopole drops out of the equation. And that's something which is really physically very reasonable, because an electron which sits in some particular part of the medium, the monopole of the CMB, it will always find an equilibrium with that, which means it cannot really create any distortion with respect to that monopole. So the monopole has nothing to do with the distortion itself. And I said already, basically all higher multiples contribute, but at low redshifts, only there it will become significant. So at high redshifts, there's another thing which is important. The dipole is actually, because of the motion of the electrons being basically very tightly coupled to the photon field, the dipole is effectively canceled by the motion of the electrons in the tight coupling limit. So the only dominant term which is really causing any distortion is basically the local quadrupole. And that is just the sheer viscosity of the photon field. So it's basically like trying to isotropize the medium by scattering photons around and mixing black bodies. You're just like saying, okay, there's a black body field and you're trying to make it isotropic and you're just taking those distribution functions and mixing them up. And you can calculate, of course, the quadrupole perturbation as well, with standard first order perturbation theory, and then you get this final expression, which is, related now to the monopole, but it basically uses approximations for the quadrupole. So you see there's this factor, which is 12, and this is, this 9 quarters larger than the classical result.
Yes, already on my end, I'm going to ask a really simple question. So when you measure the spectrum, this is a local measurement done at different places on the sky, or this is a full sky average?
Yeah, what you would want to do is you want to measure at different places in the sky, and then average things. Because if you have an angular resolution, of course, that will be allowing you to separate foregrounds and kind of things which you want to get rid of. You use the spatial information you have in order to get rid of those things.
So is there an interesting cross-correlation with polarization? This depends on the body pole as well.
The important point is that these distortions are created very, very early at redshift 10 to the 6. So you only would have these correlations if you're talking about like squeezed limit non-Gaussianity, where you get boosts in the correlation basically of very, very small scale stuff with the large scale modes. That is in principle not only important for the mu, but also for the Y-type distortion, where the Y-type distortion is actually created a bit later. So you would see some correlations there potentially. Yeah. Okay. So I mentioned already that there is this 2-to-1 ratio, and one can explain this 2-to-1 ratio of the energy release very simply as well. If you just look at the black body of some temperature T0, here's the formula. Here's spectrum, and now you say, okay, let's plot some black bodies which have slightly higher and slightly lower temperature. I just took an example, delta T over T. 0.4 to illustrate things. If you now take the average of these spectra, then you see at low frequencies this is kind of like a black body there, just Rayleigh jeans. But at high frequencies, certainly this is not a black body. This is some something in between. And the interesting thing is you can actually write down what this what the approximation for this is. It's nothing else than a Y-type distortion. So the average intensity of these two black bodies is basically an average black body. These are these terms here, where this is basically nothing else than the temperature shift, which is known from first order perturbation theory. And then the second term, which appears as a Y-type distortion. It's really like the Sunyaev-Seldovich effect, as if you were upscattering photons. And if you now go to the example which I just showed and explicitly calculate this, then in the example I created, I made the average be zero, the first order average be zero, but the second order average is non-zero. So now, if you look at the energy density, then you see that this term here has a contribution to the total energy density, which I showed before as well, of 4 times theta square, whereas the other one has only 2 times theta square. That gives you the 2-to-1 ratio, and that means that the Y distortion, the source of distortions is coming from this, whereas this here is nothing else than just shifting the black body up and down. So you have an energy release ratio which is this 2-to-1. Just to give an example, if I take the CMB sky as we see today, and I would be just averaging all these black bodies, then actually I have a distortion already, because this is a fluctuating temperature field, and you just average all of them, and you can make the numbers, and you find that the Y parameters of order, just below 10 to minus 9. In addition, this superposition will lead to a small shift in the temperature, of course. This is just to illustrate. I mean, I just want to say this is like happening when you're an electron and you're looking at the CMB sky and you ignore the dipole. I will mention the dipole in a minute. then you would be having this kind of average effect. You would see a distortion as an electron in averaging. But the largest perturbation on the sky is our dipole. And even the dipole, if we would be just averaging without taking the dipole fluctuation out, if we just average the spectrum, we will get a distortion. And this distortion is actually not that small. It's of order 3 times 10 to minus 7. So this is just an example, as I said, to illustrate that what superposition of black bodies means. The dipole would be in principle would be a factor of 100 basically larger than the effect from the superposition of black bodies than the distortions created by the dissipation of acoustic modes. It's actually also comparable to what reionization on average should do. So if you don't take that out, you would be confusing your measurement of. Sure. Yeah, that's one important point. You know exactly how the dipole looks. You can take it out, but if you don't, it was just to illustrate. You know, superposition of black bodies is nothing else than if you have a temperature variation and you do just a brute averaging, you will get a distortion. Okay. So here's more concisely how this how one has to calculate this with a second order Boltzmann treatment, and this is the energy release rate. And these are all the terms which are contributing. So here you can see the dipole appears in this gauge invariant wave where this is the V over C. And you basically, this is in the tight coupling limit is just zero at high redshifts. Then you have the quadrupole, which is the dominant term at high redshifts. And there's also effects from polarization. And the higher order multipoles, which are unimportant at high redshifts, they contribute as well. At low redshifts, they will become more and more important. Well, they are always like only contributing at the level of a few, like 10, 20%. And the important thing is that these ensemble averages here, they are all just related to the power spectrum itself. So if you know the power spectrum, you can calculate what is the energy release rates. And you can see here, this is just I'm just splitting up what are the different contributions. The dominant thing, the dominant energy release is coming from the quadrupole at high redshifts, so small scale factor. And then here during the recombination epoch, you actually see that there is contributions which are, you know, from the net dipole. So motions become important. They decouple from the local CMB dipole. And you also see that, you know, the octopole contributes something, and at low redshifts you are completely dominated by the Doppler terms from the motion. So one important thing, you have the power spectrum, you can calculate the energy release rate, but you're of course, one interesting question is at which redshift actually does a particular mode with a particular K really lead to energy release? And here I just illustrated this for some modes where you just say, okay, I just really have the energy in one particular mode at a K of 200 inverse megaparsecs. And you see that the energy release as a function of redshift is actually not just one particular redshift. It's leading to energy release over a range of redshifts where the maximum is, you know, roughly given by this expression. And this is, of course, understandable because the modes are entering the horizon and they are just oscillating for some time. And then only then they start damping, and this damping is not instantaneous; it's a range. And modes which are leading to energy release in the mu era, so the chemical potential era, I mentioned this earlier. These are modes which have 50 inverse megaparsecs to 10 to the 4 inverse megaparsecs. So these are really, really small-scale modes at early times. Where this 50 inverse megaparsecs modes, they are entering the horizon basically at 50,000, redshift of 50,000. Okay, so one can now, just for some standard power spectra, calculate what is the energy release rate. Here's just, you know, the normal standard parameterization with running and just a spectral index. And you can just do the calculation using, you know, a perturbation calculation, and you find that for these different cases, which I show here, you find how the energy release rate is. So the mu era the chemical potential error is like this redshift 50,000 to 2 times 10 to the 6. And at higher redshifts, you still have energy release. You see the energy release rate, it extends to basically all redshifts, because if there is power at small scales, it will be always releasing energy at some redshift. But at high redshifts, thermalization is so efficient that you don't see any distortion from that. And then here, the Y error, it's basically you see even some features from helium recombination, hydrogen recombination is here, and you can see how the release rates are changing. So one of the important things, if you, for example, have a smaller running, negative running, that means you have more power on small scales, which means you have more energy release. So you can see this case here is the one which has the largest energy release, whereas this one has the smallest energy release because you have a negative running, which is taking power away. And you can calculate for these cases the distortion as well. Here, just to remind you, the case with no dissipation included, which is just the other.
Mm-hmm.
You mean this one?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, with running, this is the best fit WMAP case here.
Oh.
This is the best fit WMAP case, and I just wanted to illustrate how this is changing. Yeah, sorry, I should have mentioned this. It's also interesting, I write here balance scenario, I will come back to that, but it's actually a scenario where the energy release caused by the dissipation is basically canceling the energy extraction from the cooling process. Okay, so you can calculate the distortion, and this is the distortion without any additional energy release or dissipation, and this would be the distortion with, which is, as you correctly say, is actually ruled out, but it would be the kind of distortion you get for this rather small running, value of the running, and large NS, or rather large NS. And this is the WMAP best fit case. And you see that the distortion actually is rather close to zero here. And this is this cancellation which you get. It's interesting because also the energy release rate coming from dissipation of acoustic modes has exactly the same redshift scaling. If it's just a scale invariant power spectrum, you get exactly the same redshift scaling as annihilating dark matter or this cooling process. Okay, so now one can calculate what are the kind of forecasts for PIXI. And in the original proposal of PIXI, it was stated that this will be something which the dissipation of acoustic modes will be something which they will be able to look at with rather high significance. But they, of course, the estimates were still based on old estimates, and also probably not, it wasn't updated really, but this is basically what they might be able to do. So here I just show the mu type distortion constraints for different NS and running. And you can just, you pick your favorite model and just put it in this plane, and then you can immediately read off what is the constraint you might get. So a scale invariant Harrison-Seldovich spectrum might be detected at a 2.5 sigma level. Whereas all those models which are currently favored by the data, SPT, ACT, WMAP, they all lie in this regime where it is, below 1 sigma. And in particular, they are very close to this line, which I call balanced injection scenarios, where you basically are canceling the cooling process. And that means you would not detect the distortion, but it will still tell you that you actually have been injecting so and so much energy. The constraints from Y are shown here. Same thing, put your favorite point, and you see how the what kind of constraint you get. The important thing is these distortions are very small. They are at a level of 10 to minus 9, 10 to minus 8. They are, they're really small, but in comparison to other sources of Y distortions, like reionization, energy release during reionization, or unresolved clusters, the warm, hot intergalactic medium, all this kind of stuff which is happening at low redshifts will probably contaminate this kind of constraint very much. So it will be very difficult to dig there, because you're talking about other sources which have Y distortions created at a level of 100 times stronger, probably. That's somehow bad news, but it's also interesting to think about this now from the perspective of anisotropies, because you can actually, in those cases, you can also think about anisotropic signals. If it's 100 times stronger signal during reionization, then fluctuations, for example, created by small density perturbations, will, you know, which, for example, optical depth fluctuations can be at the level of 1%, as I understand, then you could be able to, you know, use the scale dependence of these signals to subtract them and learn something. But yeah, the Y distortions in principle are going to be hard to use for constraining early universe. But the Mu distortions, which are have a different spectral shape and a different dependence on frequency, those are the ones which probably will be, you know, you will probably be able to dig those out, which is optimistic, but yeah, so is this all one can really do? I just did the standard stuff here. I just said an S and a running of a spectral index. But this is not all, right? Because the real constraints on the power spectrum, here from a paper by Bringman, the real constraints on the power spectrum are, you know, here at CMB scales, we know it's very, very tight. Everything is, you know, you don't have very much freedom there. But at small scales, things are becoming, you know, much more wide open. The constraint which is coming from primordial black holes is very, very weak, but it's going, of course, to extremely small scales. So it's very strong in some sense. But then there is this limit which is coming from ultra-compact mini-halos, and as I understand, those estimates or constraints are rather, you know, still rather model-dependent in to some extent. So these constraints should be taken with a grain of salt. Still, they are, you know, at least a factor of 100 weaker than those constraints from CMB, anisotropies, and large-scale structure. But if you actually throw in the spectral distortions, then you will be able to probe the range of scales, which I just indicated here. And you will actually be able to improve the constraints basically down to the same level as the CMB constraints, if you were measuring the CMB spectrum as promised with PIXI. And that, of course, would be an interesting way to extend basically the lever arm on the power spectrum. And that, of course, is in turn allowing you to constrain, you know, different possible inflation scenarios. So we calculated some cases where we just, you know, basically said, okay, there is freedom at scales below 1 inverse megaparsecs or at Lazar K. And we can basically, you know, we all know inflation models, you can do basically whatever you want in some sense, as long as there's no data constraining it. So one can just play with those things and just say, for example, there's a step in the small scale power spectrum at some scales. And then you see, if you put the step at different scales, what are the kind of possible constraints from PIXI, and what are the kind of constraints which are there from COBE already? So COBE FIRAS, which is a very solid constraint, is actually already pretty good in comparison to the ultra-compact mini-halos. It's, you know, comparable. It's maybe a factor of 10 weaker. One of the interesting things I want to point out, we found with Adrian, we found this expression, which is just giving you a direct tool to compute what is the distortion you get for any power spectrum. So you just plug in your power spectrum, do this integral, which is very simple, and then you have the approximate values for mu and y. So that's like anybody can just you know, use this for whatever power spectra they can come up with whatever model they have. It's an integral constraint on the total energy release in principle. Just another example, but then I will stop with the examples here. You can also say there's a bend in the slope of the power spectrum. You have a flaring. For example, running mass models have these kind of features, as I understand. And you can again ask what are the kind of constraints. And this is here on what is the at which scale the bend appears, and at which you know, what kind of slope you get afterwards. You have these constraints. Yeah, so here is the visibility function of spectral distortions, which goes up to, you know, distortions are not created at redshifts above 2 × 10⁶. And that is included here. So you can integrate the whole power spectrum, but the contribution to the energy release, which creates mu distortions, is not large. So yeah, you could also say, let's go just up to 2 times 10 to the 6 and make this. But this formula kind of is a good way to estimate this.
So, I guess the question I asked at the beginning, so here you're saying that the effect is just a mu and a bar.
Yep.
Right? Mm-hmm. So if I go to low frequencies, is that still true?
No, absolutely correct. At low frequencies, you have a far more rich, in principle, more rich shape of the spectrum.
But you're saying you don't detect, you cannot see them.
At low frequencies, you have a hard time to detect things. However, it is true, and you can calculate those distortions and the shape of the distortions precisely. And if you would have access to the very low frequency part, I'm talking about like 1 gigahertz or below, you would be actually able to probably distinguish in a much more, you have more possibility to distinguish different energy release processes.
So like what, up to, down to what frequency is mu and bar enough?
Well, this is basically just up to, the normal standard CMB frequencies, like 30-ish gigahertz down to 30-ish gigahertz. Okay, so I mentioned this is interesting. There is this correlation which you can come up with of the mu distortions and the temperature field, because if you have non-Gaussianity, primordial squeezed limit non-Gaussianity, you can have, when there's a large-scale mode present, and the small-scale modes, basically you get an enhancement of power there if you have non-Gaussianity in this limit. And that means that you get more energy release, that means you have more distortions. And if you the spatial correlations are coming from the large-scale modes, which are also present in the CMB temperature field, and you can basically correlate those and get some interesting effect or a possibility to constrain non-Gaussianity at small scales. However, if you look at the number, of course, one should say the FNL, effective FNL you're talking about for the small scale non-Gaussianity is rather large. It's not very close to anything which is, at CMB scales. Still, this is an interesting problem and interesting effect to look at. And also, I think it is interesting to include as well the possible correlation of the Y distortions with this, because there could be some correlations which are, again, separating Y and mu distortions. Okay, I don't know. I suppose I was rather slow. How much time do I have? Yeah. Okay. Then I should be okay. So I just wanted to finish with a couple of words about the cosmological recombination spectrum from basically for redshift 1000. So you have the recombination. The recombination lines produced by the recombination of hydrogen and helium. So let's just make simple numbers. Hydrogen recombination. You have, it's clear that when you recombine, you inject something like 13.6 eV of energy into the CMB. And this energy, in fact, is not thermalized, because you're injecting this at so late times that thermalization process and any, even electron scattering, is very inefficient already in terms of energy exchange. So the effective Y parameter, the way to communicate from one part of the spectrum to the next, is really, really small, very slow. So you're basically injecting those photons at different resonances, or also in the continua, and nothing is changing them very much. The only thing is that you're now doing this at many, many redshifts, and you, of course, get a convolution of the redshift dependence of recombination with those delta functions. But if you just make the numbers, you find that the distortion which you overall expect should be of the order of 10 to minus 9, 10 to minus 8, just from the energy density. That's very small. But it turns out that there is, of course, frequency dependence, and you might be able to see something at low frequencies, for example, and at high frequencies. I wanted to mention as well that this has been, of course, realized in the early papers already, in particular in the early works on recombination, but there only the Lyman alpha distortion was considered, whereas, for example, Viktor Dubrovich in 1975 then also said, well, there's also these recombination photons created by captures of electrons to the highly excited states, where you have the cascade of electrons to the lower states and get emission of low-frequency photons. So you can calculate this, and this is one of the byproducts of my work on recombination, on the cosmological recombination history. You can calculate the distortion as a function of frequency as it would be observed today. So this is the redshifted Lyman alpha line here, and this is the redshifted Balmer alpha, Paschen bracket, and so on. You can see here as well, I indicated the separate contribution of the Balmer continuum, Passion bracket, and Fund continuum, and just to show they have been included as well. And they actually are not so small additional recombination photons. They add some additional photons. If you make the total number of photons, you find that something like 5 photons per hydrogen atom are emitted. So just to emphasize here, if you would be having a recombination to the ground state, and that would be the process which is allowed, then you would have exactly 1 photon per hydrogen atom emitted. As you all know, recombination to the ground state in astrophysical plasma is basically never or very rarely, in this condition, not possible. It's very highly suppressed. So you are going to the second state. And in the second state, you have 2 possibilities. You go from the 2s to the ground state and emit 2 photons in the 2-photon emission, or you go from the Lyman alpha from the 2p to the ground state, emitting a Lyman alpha photon, which is something which is in between 1 and 3, depending on what is the ratio. And then the recombinations to the highly excited states allow you to create more photons in addition. So the effective net number is something like 5 per hydrogen atom. You can, of course, from the observational point of view, what you are interested in is what is this kind of distortion relative to the CMB. And here it's just really the same plot as before, but divided by the black body. And you can see at high frequencies, terahertz, there is a huge distortion. This is the Lyman alpha distortion, and people understand, of course, that this distortion is really large, but it's very, very far in the Wien tail, and in particular, there's the cosmic infrared background with very, very many, features and spectral features, which it will make it very hard to distinguish this rather broad, featureless, Lyman alpha distortion. Close to the maximum of the black body, you have these, you see some variability. But the relative distortion is really small. It's 10 to minus 9 there. That's nano-K. It's very hard to measure anything there. You could maybe think about template, using this as a template, because if recombination happens like this, you have this exact template in some sense. It's just limited by your understanding of atomic data and what kind of effects you include in the calculation. And you could do the same as gravitational wave people, just dig in the noise by template, matching the template. At lower frequencies, around 10 to 1, you see that the distortion rises. The relative distortion just rises, and you, in principle, are hitting even the limit of, 10 to minus 7, 10 to minus 6 at 1 gigahertz, 2 gigahertz. You are reaching above this limit of 10 to minus 7. That is only a factor of 100 lower than COBE FIRAS. But unfortunately, PIXI is only measuring up to 30 gigahertz, down to 30 gigahertz. So they are not really looking at this kind of low frequency part. And in the regime between 30 and 1 gigahertz, there's a lot of possibilities to, you can even improve in principle, you have more details in the energy release in the mu and y type distortions, even there already. True, but there's also the interesting thing. First of all, the slope is different, okay. But then the other thing is that there is this variability, and this variability is unique to the recombination lines from hydrogen. It will be very hard to mimic by instrumental other astrophysical processes. So there is some small hope that this will be interesting. And one of the important things to emphasize is these lines, they actually come from slightly higher redshifts than the CMB anisotropies. And I already have here this large redshift range because I'm also going to mention the helium doubly ionized and singly ionized helium lines, which are coming from even higher redshifts. So this is interesting. You can actually, by looking at the recombination lines from the three different epochs, you can actually probe the state of the universe basically at those higher redshifts. So in the case of hydrogen, it's basically 100,000 years before those anisotropies. So helium, you can do the same calculation. I just show here the comparison of the just hydrogen spectrum in the blue, and the red is with helium included. And you can see that there's particular features which are actually sticking out quite significantly, just introduced by the presence of helium in the universe. If you change the helium contents, then these features become stronger or less strong, and you can see the differences in principle. You see also these non-trivial changes in the shape of the spectrum. and the positions of the maxima and so on that change. And I mentioned and promised already that there's, you know, these two epochs of helium recombination which are leading to these additional photons. And if there's something non-standard happening here, for example, energy release, or just here, or just there, or anything, you are actually having these different stages of the epochs. You can basically, in principle, could be digging in and understanding what is if there's any non-standard processes happening. So the recombination spectrum, in principle, allows you to gives you another way to do cosmology. You are depending on you know, helium abundance, baryon number, or hydrogen number, and even the temperature of the CMB, because you're shifting the positions of the peaks of the lines. You can measure, in principle, the temperature monopole. And in particular, if you are really thinking that recombination has happened how we believe it happened, then you should be seeing exactly this kind of recombination spectrum, which I just showed you. And if there's something else happening, then that should be showing up in the recombination lines as well. And in particular, when you're interested in constraining inflation, this is actually an important tool to measure directly, to basically get a handle on the recombination history. Because the recombination history, it turns out, you can believe that the calculations which have been done are now precise, but nobody has really measured it, right? So one has to turn it around and say, how well can the data constrain the recombination history? And just the CMB anisotropies alone are not doing, they are already having some constraints. If you're just doing this very freely, there are some constraints, but it's not enough. So there might be a possibility to look at this with a recombination spectrum. And this is the kind of non-standard things you can think about, but I think I have been saying enough about this. So I think that, you know, CMB spectrum, the energy spectrum, deviations from a black body is really a really interesting window to the early universe, which has, you know, over the past 20 years, 25 years, hasn't been, you know, pushed very much. And with Pixie and maybe Core, you know, a modified version of Core, it might become accessible in the future. And you can learn about, you know, because the thermalization process is very, very simple, you can actually learn about non-standard processes. You can calculate the distortions rather precisely and learn about those processes which are happening. Non-standard processes, but also standard processes. That's a very important point, actually. There is standard processes in the universe which are leading to these distortions. So you know they will be there. And you can also, you're pretty sure, recombination spectrum should probably be there at that level. So you basically are, when you have an instrument, you design it to do that, you will basically return definitely with something in your hands when you do it. The only problem, of course, is how much of a, you know, cost it will be to do this, and what is when is the time. But yeah, and learning about inflation from the dissipation of acoustic modes, I think that is very interesting and exciting, because it is a very different window to the very small-scale power spectrum, and that constrains different models of inflation. And these aspects about non-Gaussianity, small-scale non-Gaussianity, are certainly also very interesting. I think I'll stop there. Thank you.
Next generation is an experiment that could actually see these expected effects. Is that, like, even technologically feasible at this point, or it's just a matter of cost? Or
so Pixie, for example, as I understand, they, from the technological point of view, they have not pushed the sensitivity to the absolute maximum they could. They basically guided themselves by looking at what is the lensed E modes. Those are the confusion for the B modes, and they kick in at a scale of, you know, L of 100 or 80 or whatever, and they know where they have to put their sensitivity curve to get the B modes basically tailored for the B modes. So that means the detector size and all these kind of things are optimized for those detections. If you would make the detector larger, more, you know, you can probably, from the technological point of view, can probably dig deeper. But the motivation is the important thing, and that's the reason why, you know, these works. I'm hoping that at some point people will really say that this is, you know, something one should go after. And Core seems to be in principle, having the chance to be more sensitive than Pixie, but they are so far not having a monopole measurement. And that is the important thing. But they have a budget which they are looking at, which is actually $1 billion. They are trying to propose some mission light of that size, which is, you know, significantly more than Pixie. So the question is there a way to change the core concept that it can do, you know, bipolarization with 10 times better than Planck, plus very high sensitivity spectral distortions. It's hard to say when money will be there to, for such kind of things. But it is definitely a really interesting window of the in addition, just coming from the CMB. Chris?
At what level do you need to have a non-standard transfer function for, say, isocurvature fluctuations in that megaparsec versus 10 to the 4 megaparsec per scale for it to show up?
Yeah, so there has been a calculation by Dent, James Dent, where they basically just used isocurvature modes, Bayesian isocurvature modes, and just calculated the calculated the energy release from that. And I believe if you would be saying a factor of 10, if you would say 10% like the constraints from large scale, from CMB scales on isocurvature modes, if you would fold that in and assume that this is at its small scales is the same, you would probably not get any interesting constraints. So if you drop that constraint and say there's a lot of freedom in principle at small scales because nobody told you what's happening there, then you can play with the numbers and can get interesting constraints. I don't know exactly what was the amplitude. I think it was of the order of 10 to the minus 5 amplitude, which is really much larger than what you would expect from large scales. So it's really, you need a large isocurvature mode to get any interesting constraint.
Yes.